Welcome to The Systemic Lens, a podcast which uses systemic theory to explore and understand films, TV, music, and literature.
Taking a systemic approach means thinking about people in relation to the world or system that they live in. That means thinking about people and their relationship with others and the bits of identity that make them who they are, such as their gender, age, ethnicity, social and cultural identity.
These bits of identity that make a person who they are shapes how they see and interact with the world and the other people around them.
When we are thinking systemically, we are keeping in mind that every person finds their place in their world, in their own unique space that has a unique perspective on what is going on.
A systemic approach uses both a zoom and a wide-angle lens to engage closely with people and their intimate relationships, whilst also keeping the wider context of the social environment within our field of vision.
Through our systemic lens, we will bring about new ways to explore cinema, art, and cultural artifacts.
We are going to be talking and discussing the film Everything Everywhere All at Once, which we just discovered is the most awarded film of all time. That's right, Cesar?
Yeah, wow. We did do this recording before the Oscars.
Yeah.
And then suddenly thought, oh my God, we better release it. So we will try to read a bit of a synopsis because I don't think we do a very good attempt at it during the episode. But for those who haven't seen the film, and I fully recommend that you do, so maybe just press pause now, go away, watch the film and come back. But if you haven't seen it, I'm sure you will enjoy the discussion anyway. But it's about a woman who is drowning under the stress of her family's failing laundromat, her ailing marriage, and the elderly father who disapproves of her life choices. But it is the widening gulf between Evelyn and her daughter that threatens to unravel the fabric of existence as she learns that she is just one in a vast multiverse of Evelyn's and the only one who can save it. So I really don't know if that summary encapsulates the craziness and the vastness of this movie. But what we try to do in our discussion is really think about some of the key ideas and key concepts that come out of the film, and we apply some systemic thinking to some of the various things of the film, such as multiverse and family relationships and intergenerational trauma and migration.
Unlike Systemic Way episodes where it's the two of us having a conversation with a guest, here we are in conversation with other systemic therapists. We've got Becky, Danilin, Anok, Naz, and yourself and me.
Yeah, it feels like we've put a band together. We've got the Beatles together to this. So we do hope to do more of these Systemic Lens episodes. So we are open to suggestions and requests. So if there's any particular films or pieces of music or genres that we'd like us to explore. But yeah, we're really interested in what people make of this and what some of the systemic ideas you all have as well in connection to the film.
For people who haven't seen the film, ideally would want them to go and see the film right before coming back to this, but we kind of need to give a bit of a skeleton.
Yeah,
I think there is a basic story to it, you know, a basic narrative of a family, an immigrant family, struggling with their taxes and their failing business of a laundromat. The mum of the family is completely stressed out and overwhelmed by this process.
Dissatisfied with life.
Bit of a kind of existential crisis. Difficult relationship with her daughter. Her marriage is breaking down. And also her dad is visiting. Is that right? Is her dad visiting? Or is,
I think he's had to come over and live with her. That's the impression I got, that he's now so, like, because he's quite old and ill, that he's coming over to...
She's about to assume care for her father, who she also had a very difficult relationship with, or has had a very difficult relationship. And then it's all leading towards this New Year's Eve party that they're planning.
It's a bit of a retelling of, like, those 20, roaring 20s American literature novels, isn't it? A lot like a Tennessee Williams play, or I think there's a lot of those films, those themes are like the failed American dream.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to make sense of that failure.
You'd always read it as it's a film exploring what the meaning of life is. So it's like existentialism versus nihilism, and kind of looking at it, is life meaningful? Is it meaningless? Or is it about the interpretation of life we apply? And it's told through the story of this family and the journey that they go through, and the kind of this idea of the multiverse. But they don't overplay the multiverse. It's not... I bought straight into that because I was just like, yeah, Marvel Phase 4. I understand this concept. But it was almost irrelevant. Even if you didn't get that, it didn't actually matter. The narrative in itself was what mattered, not the kind of understanding the sci-fi behind it, because it's almost that it doesn't make sense, and maybe that's the point. It's not meant to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think even like the way it was shot, like the beginning and some of the environments, it was just so drab. Like, you know, it was just so mundane. Like the scenes in the tax office in particular, for me, I was like drawn in. Some of the sounds were quite loud, like bells and things going off. And then, you know, when you was introduced to this different possibility, this different dimension, it was just so stark. So I enjoyed the fact that it created this quite depressing environment, really. Like, you know, even within that room where there was loads of little sticky notes, and it was just overwhelming. Like at the beginning, I kind of felt a bit overwhelmed, and it was just the stress of like day-to-day life was pretty visceral, I think.
I think for me, one of the things that really stood out at the beginning actually was just to do with representation, that I suppose connects to what you're saying, Danilyn, with the American dream. Like it was so, you know, you're seeing this Chinese American story and the stories of immigration that it brought up, but also to do with power and control and the, you know, the white privilege within it and the society and the structure of society. And I thought, but I just loved actually just seeing a film where all the main characters were, you know, Chinese American. And it made me think how you just don't see that very often. And I thought that was quite powerful.
Quite an interesting sort of metaphor of that with the actor as well. So the actor that plays Wayman was a child actor. Like, so he was in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
He was in the Goonies, I think.
In the Goonies, yeah.
And he was like this amazing like 80s child actor, and then ended up going out of acting because there weren't any roles. There weren't any sort of Chinese American roles that he could have. And he came and became like a stunt director or involved in kind of behind the scenes. And then he came back for this role. He sort of went back into acting after having seen Michelle Yeoh, who plays Evelyn, in Crazy Rich Asians, and kind of said, oh, maybe there is a bit more representation now. So there's a kind of a quite interesting sort of pattern, yeah, that like mirroring basically that goes on in the film and also in the real world, which I guess is another sort of multiverse.
Yeah, okay, definitely.
Blown my mind. It's basically Goonies Part 2 is Data grew up and this is what happened. Like my little brain's just gone, oh my god, it's Data. It is.
It's interesting, though, them patterns that you're talking about, Becky, because even, like, Wayman's character, for me, was a, like, behind-the-scenes kind of orchestrator, in a way. So similar to, like, his career, maybe, you know, it was like the camera wasn't able to focus on him for so long just because of, you know, the cinema world being so binary and stuff. So yeah, even his character kind of embodied that. But I absolutely loved martial arts films, and like probably for about 10 years of my life, I only watched martial arts films pretty much with one of my best mates. And just, yeah, the amount of films, even with Michelle Yeoh, like for me, it was sort of nostalgic in so many different ways. But then the film held the weight because it was, I think it was just so expansive, the idea, that I started thinking about my own kind of history and nostalgia of looking at other films. So then I was like, oh, what element is the kid from the Goonies? Like, what element is Wayman bringing from that? So it just became really kind of complex and like rich.
Yeah, straight away, it brought the theme of like a parallel life in that. Because I was like, oh my God, yeah, that's the kid from Goonies. And what happened to him, you know, and where his life went after becoming a child star, and then where he is now. So yeah, straight away it brought me into a kind of different zone in watching that film, actually. Should we name who the different characters of the film are? We did this in the previous episode, almost like a genogram, which can be quite helpful. So we've got Evelyn, the mum, her particular status as a female. I said the mum, but it's very interesting that her character is very much the mum, the wife, the daughter. It's very much defined in these kind of roles. Maybe we can go in more about Evelyn's story. But then Waymond, the husband, who's this kind of what, happy-go-lucky. I mean, how would we describe Waymond?
A bit silly.
Kind of like slapstick in some ways, but kind of like light-hearted, maybe irreverent. Like I love Oscar Wilde, and I think it was Oscar Wilde. I don't want to like misquote. It's probably not him and someone else. I think he says, life is too important to be taken seriously, which I love that quote. But for me, Wayman embodies that kind of light-footedness through life. So it's interesting, Becky, to hear that he was behind the scenes in his real life, because he feels very much a supporting character, but actually he has a lot more strength than maybe initially he might be kind of portrayed as.
He's the hopeless romantic. It's like, almost like a role reversal of him being the hopeless romantic that's just in love with her across all these multiverses. And she's symbolically Neo, the one. She is the one that's throughout the universe has had to hold it together and save the world.
They're positioned very differently in terms of like the adversity they face in life. Like, he really sees the best in people, and he treats people as he wants to treat them, regardless of how they treat him. And I think, like, as Anna was saying, I think there's a lot of it's perceived as a weakness at first, but it's quite a strength to keep that stance regardless of how others around you behave towards you. Like, to maintain that posture of, I'm going to treat people well because this is how I want to treat people regardless of how they behave towards me.
In the one of the other multiverse realities, when he's the kind of suave Waymond, he does say that, doesn't he? Where he says, like, I choose to be kind and see the best in others as a way of kind of like surviving this crazy world. But there's an intention there, which is this kind of kind, happy-go-lucky, bit silly, playful man is a very different representation of masculinity in the typical films, right? In Hollywood, particularly, it's not the big, strong alpha male coming in to save the situation through his kind of brute strength or bravery. It's a very different approach, which I found very refreshing.
I really saw that sort of kindness and that kind of like him taking a position on that and saying, actually, this is my way of fighting and getting through the day as a kind of small act of resistance. That's his kind of way of resisting, I don't know, the kind of oppression or the pressure to for maybe a more kind of alpha masculine style, or the oppression of actually, you know, immigrant life in America. And the real strength in that position.
But that's actually, that relationship is actually more reflective of what would be culturally appropriate. So like in China and kind of like Asia in general, women hold the financial responsibility, men just go out to work. And there's that kind of the role reversal, and there's almost like this kind of idea of going, oh, Asian men are very feminine, and it's women are very serious, and they're almost reflecting that truth versus the kind of atypical Western masculinity concept. So it's a different stance on what it is to be a man, but more from an Asian perspective, I think. But there's something really powerful about, you know, this juxtaposition between real life struggles and everyday struggles and this like bigger world is evil out there. And I kind of find this just in life in general. So you've got like Black Lives Matter and LGBTQ rights, and there's all these things that you really need to be really concerned about. But at the end of the day, you've got to pay your bills. So there's that really powerful moment where right at the beginning, he's got rid of the closet and he's like, you've got to save the world. And she went, I'm really sorry, I'm busy today. I've got to do my taxes. And it's so true, because where do you give, at what point do you give so much of yourself to this bigger cause versus actually the small points in life are what's really important? And there's something about the first fight scene where he's just using everyday objects. He's not got like a magic weapon. He didn't come out with like this sword. He just uses gravel from his fish tank. And I love that, because it was something about using everyday weapons and everyday tools that you've got around you to almost fight this evil or resistance of the taxman or symbolically whatever they represent. And it was just using what you had at hand. So there's something about coming back and forth between this big political ideals of good and evil and morality versus just everyday life and struggles of marriage and kids and keeping a business going.
It's really interesting, because like every character has an arc, right? A kind of story of where they were, but he doesn't. He's kind of consistent in this: be kind, be lighthearted, keep putting the googly eyes on things, because that's how you make change. And we as an audience, I think, have the arc around him. And I mean, if I can explain that more, is when I first saw him, my first reaction to him was a bit like, help your wife with the taxes. Come on, like, don't let her have all this pressure on her. It's crushing her. And I had a bit of a reaction to him. And then when we got introduced to the Alpha Waymond, who came from the other multiverse, and he was this badass, all the shades of those old karate movies, almost Jackie Chan style, you know. Yeah. I was like, all right, cool, all right, I like him now, you know. And then as the film progressed, it was me who had to change around him by saying, no, I have now recognized the strength or the benefits in his approach that he stayed so true to. So I thought that was a real interesting narrative technique around him.
I really thought that was a bit like a systemic reframe in some ways. It was just kind of saying, actually, you can see it from a different perspective. You know, and I guess Evelyn starts to see it from a different perspective, it being really frustrating and annoying for her at the beginning, a bit like for the audience as well. But it's that kind of reframe of actually, what are the positives or what are the strengths in something?
That can order change in perspective. Start,
yeah, take it away from the problem-saturated narrative.
Mm-hmm. When you were talking, Zeze, it made me think about that, like, maybe even kind of systemic kind of therapy or the space to kind of co-construct. Like, I think there's a lot of films where the dominant sort of narratives are the reflective of our own meta-narratives in society, really. So even some of the characters and the archetypes, you think, ah, okay, I can sort of predict, you know. When I watch a lot of kind of Hollywood films, I have a sense of kind of what's going on, maybe, and the range of the character. But for me, yeah, it allowed me to kind of co-construct my own perception of these archetypes, of these characters and stuff. And I think because they change so many times, it made me think that when I actually watched it, I was proper knackered, to be honest. I'd had a long day, and it was quite a trippy experience, just because it moved so much of the film. And it then made me think, you know, if I watched it five different times in five different states of mind, like my relationship with the concepts, what I tune into, what I kind of zoom out would change. But it definitely felt like a kind of co-construction, like it felt like a dialogue with the film and my own perception. Whereas some films, I feel like it feels like a monologue, really. You know, there's not much you can input. Whereas I think I was kind of speaking in my mind about the film more than as much as I was watching it sometimes.
I remember when we were talking and I kept on bugging you all about, has everyone watched it? I mean, I don't know how many of you said I actually fell asleep. And I fell asleep when I first watched it. But I begged my partner to watch it. She fell asleep. And then when I watched it the second time, I was glued. I was like, how did I fall asleep? I think it's just an overwhelming sensation. That film is so fast-paced at times. It's so much that it's almost like I went to shut down. And I wanted to ask you lot what sense you lot made of that.
I did not have that. My brain just went, because I think I was wired, because I was going in with the idea of going, I need to watch this and to study it rather than just watch a movie. I'm studying this because I need to talk about it later. So I went in just absolutely wired and glued straight away. My brain just kind of fried to the point where at the end of it, I kind of sat and smelled my coffee and went, someone spiked me, because I can't be 100% sure that I haven't like tripped through the whole thing. So there was a lot of it where I was like, did I just make that up? Is it 2 o'clock in the morning and I've made that up, or did that actually happen? And then I thought about it and I thought, no, the absurdity in the movie and that some of that slapstick and some of that actually has a function, like a philosophical function of the absurdity of life and the absurdity of reality. But no, I think because I'd gone in with the idea of, no, I need to, this is a study session rather than I just need to watch the movie.
It's making me laugh, says it, because I had the exact same experience that you described. So me and my wife watched it, both fell asleep. And then the second time I thought, it felt like the initial 40 minutes was just not even the same film. And I think it's like the wider context like created the film for me. And I can't believe when I think about that first half an hour, I was a bit kind of like a bit distant from it in a way, you know. I liked the action and I was like, oh, okay, cool. Like this is kind of paying homage to some classic films. But I thought, wow, like to revisit something again with a different frame of mind, it was transformative, I think.
The first time I saw it was in the cinema. So it was before we decided to do this. And I did find it really overwhelming, like just the sensory overload and being in a cinema and it being on a massive screen and the sound, and just, I remember the sound being really loud. And then when there's the scene where it all goes silent and there's just the two rocks, I remember just feeling like so grateful for a bit of quiet and like I enjoyed it, but it was just overwhelming and this kind of sense of like, oh, there's a bit of peace and there's a bit of a reprieve from what feels like this kind of really intense film. And then it was really I think it is a film that you need to see more than once, because I think you do see it completely differently the next time you see it. You're allowed to see it in a different light because some of the sensory stuff just isn't as intense, I guess.
I have to say, I never want to watch a film more than once. I'm really like, seen it, not interested. But as everybody said, with this film, it's one of those ones where, for me anyway, I'm like, yeah, you need to see it again. There's going to be new things to pick up on. But I think when I've been listening to everyone now, I was just thinking that like everyone said about the sensory overload. And I was reminded, Cesar, I don't want to speak for you, but I was making me think about, like, you know, people who might be experiencing that in everyday life. And we were given that experience through the cinema.
Yeah, the ADHD and the experience of ADHD, I think, was one of the themes that the directors and the filmmakers wanted to explore through this film, particularly with Evelyn, the kind of the central character, more the kind of hyperactivity, I guess, and I guess connecting it to the metaphor of the multiverse. Should we start talking about that? What sense we made of the multiverse and how that was used as a way of talking about experience?
I think visually it was interesting because the way they branched out the multiverse was almost the way, as soon as I saw it, I went, oh, that's a brain. That's how neurosynapses work, and they fire off and they go off into tangents. So now that you've made the ADHD link, it actually makes even more sense, because you almost have to do something completely absurd in this reality to flip off to a different reality. And it's almost the way your neuropathways work. They don't necessarily go from one point to another to be logical. In neurodiversity, one flips off here and one flips off there. So it sparks different processes. So I thought that was fascinating. And even when they're visual, they have the brain and then they have this multiverse. And I'm just like, maybe that's why I made the link automatically. So there was something quite powerful about, if you ever look at neuropathways, that's how they look.
I literally thought Google Maps when I saw it, because I'd been on a road trip for like 1,000 miles, So I think, again, it's like your own sense of kind of experience like seeps into the film. Like it's got enough tolerance and a bit of a canvas for you to kind of do that and stuff. But I think in our kind of systemic theory, we talk about the multiverse, you know, like in as like a concept. So it was interesting to see it kind of like accessible, you know, like, oh, okay, this is like a useful metaphor and a platform that we can kind of think about. So it's felt familiar, but I've just not seen it kind of done that much in that way.
On the face of it, I guess it's a metaphor, maybe it's a bit of a metaphor for like the infinite possibilities that one person's life can be. And I also wonder if it can also be thought of like almost from like the opposite point of view, and as if many people can have the same experience but have a very different perception of that experience.
Yeah, I was actually just thinking when I was hearing then of like the social graces in terms of if it's one person, but if one of those things change, how different your life can be and the influence and the impact of those things on the you know, that what life might offer you or the opportunities you might get in different areas.
Because there was some scenes, wasn't there, Julie, where Michelle Yeoh like had these incredible martial arts skills. So even it made me think about like our professional identities, you know, different facets of our identity, but like skill as well, or discipline or pursuit, and how that kind of can foreground parts of our identity and then marginalize other aspects. Like it felt like, this was just my memory of it, but it felt like, you know, it was something, some kind of pursuit that she wanted to, but it was like, oh, I never got to do that because of her day-to-day, or maybe her parental or other relational kind of aspects of that identity. So it was, yeah, it's that kind of thing that you wished you'd done, or you know, you regret, and what would have happened if I'd have taken that path.
And some of those paths, you have choice to determine it, but then there are other times when you don't, and it's just chance that leads you down a different path. In the way that they introduced some of the aspects of the multiverse showed that. And there were times where she was the master of her destiny, and there were times where she wasn't.
And on the surface level, or in a kind of more of an initial kind of reading, the multiverse was used in a bit like the difficulties that we might have. I mean, kind of existential musings about parallel lives. You know, what if I did this at this stage of my life? What would my life been like? And I mean, we've all probably had those thoughts, right? And they come and go at different times in our lives. The initial split was when she decided to go to America with Waymond and defy her father. I think that's the kind of first image of when one of the splits in this parallel universe occurred in the multiverse. But I mean, which is interesting. And I think it deals a lot with the immigration story, you know, of what if I stayed with my family? What if I stayed there? What would life been like? I think that's an interesting leaning into it, reading that. But I think it goes further than that. And I think how they use the multiverse, I think, is a bit of a representation of the challenge of our times now, that the multiverse is what we're living now, this kind of the internet, the age of the internet and the age of overload, and where you could be in so many different places or have so much different experiences all while sitting on the toilet, you know, or whatever, yeah. You know, like you could be in a cave in one country and then you could be in Hollywood and you could be in so many different kind of experiences.
And we live so many different roles, don't we? We step in and out of so many different roles in our normal lives now, even more so than we used to maybe like, I don't know, 50 years ago.
I think you illustrated that so well. You know, when you were saying, says about kind of being omnipresent or being present in other places, I think it illustrated it so well. Like one of my favorite scenes is, you know, when they are them rocks, because there's a stillness in the film and there's an engagement with the environment. Like, but in some ways, when you were saying, Becky, before, it made me think about like the potential overwhelm or overload of like meaning, you know, it was like, wow, everything could be meaningful. And in some ways the duality with like nihilism, like made me think, felt a bit kind of almost like relaxing.
Thank you.
you know, the experience of that nihilistic, like, we're just stone, can't really do anything. There was something of this real juxtaposition between, like, the fast-paced nature, and then it's like, ah, okay, we can't really do anything now. You know, we don't have access to that technology, which sometimes if I go camping, it's a similar experience. I'm like, oh, just kind of a rock. Like, I can't really, I haven't got access to the multiverse. So in some way, it was kind of similar.
I think it functioned more as a, like a film trope rather than the film being about the multiverse. So I was trying to explain to my friend of going, okay, if I was going to explain it to her, what is it? What would I watch it? And I was like, it's like The Matrix meets Mr. Nobody. And if Modern Families was Chinese, and it was the only way I could try and explain the kind of genre of movie to kind of encapsulate all of it. So it's got that kind of, you know, Mr. Nobody, if I had multiple options, what would I do? Still got the Matrixy tropes about the new on the one, but essentially about a family. It's about a family. So like I said, I don't think I understood how that multiverse or how that system functioned. I don't think it had some metaphysical, quantum physics-y explanation to why. But I think that didn't matter. Whereas if it was a pure sci-fi movie, I'd be annoyed at the end of it if they hadn't explained the rules of that reality and why it works and why it didn't. They never explained any of that. And the bad guy was a donut, for God's sake. Like, there's just such a, like, that's the evil. The great evil is a donut.
Was it a bagel or a donut?
It was a donut. But they've clearly never had Krispy Kremes because they've missed that trick completely. If they're going to talk about nihilism and the nothingness of a donut, try Krispy Kremes and I'll question you.
I thought it was a bagel, which in itself is brilliant because, I mean, we've interpreted it as a different item.
It was a bagel. It's called the Everything Bagel.
But didn't you have, like, donut with sprinkles? Yeah. Donut with sprinkles.
You was just hungry for that donut, I think.
This goes back to the question of was I high when I watched this? Like, I think I might have been.
I don't know if it matters if it was a donut or a bagel. But for me, like, what that represented was American consumerism and capitalism. Because it was like this, I imagine, I've never really ordered something like this in America, but that you go into a sandwich store and you order a bagel and you can't choose, so you just get everything that they have on it. And it's that's also fitting in with the multiverse, is we want to live every single possibility, we want to have everything that life can possibly offer us. And that was this bagel or donut. It was the overload and the overwhelmed of, we think we need everything and we think we want everything, and actually we can't tolerate it, and we'd rather just be this rock in the desert, and we're at our most happy and most at peace there.
I had an experience of similar, going to Subway, and I was like, yeah, just everything. And then the thing was so packed, it exploded and half of it fell on the floor. So I ended up not even being able to enjoy what it was. And that made me think of it, you know, like this kind of, you want everything, but, you know, and then you're losing, you're not actually ever tasting it. I think even in my cooking, like, development, I used to just overload it with different spices and this, that, and then you can't quite taste anything, you know. So I'm trying to simplify it. But what's drive to want to do so many different things, you know? You want to do this, and you want to try that, and want to become this, and you want to train in this, and then you're just spreading yourself so thin that you never get to actually either master anything or enjoy any of it.
What is that? I got bored one day and I put everything on a bagel. Everything. All my hopes and dreams, my old report cards, every breed of dog, every last personal ad on Craigslist. Sesame, poppy seed, salt. And it collapsed in on itself. Because you see, when you really put everything on a bagel, it becomes this.
Come on, Evelyn.
The truth.
What is the truth?
Nothing matters. Doesn't it
made me think of, like, desire as well, just on the back of what we're talking about, that almost like, you know, again, that duality between nihilism and like everything all at once, or, you know, the rich kind of infinite like potential of life. But then in some ways, like when you desire something, you want it, and, you know, once you consume it, like eating McDonald's or whatever, it can feel a bit vacuous. So then you want more, it keeps going. So in some ways, it's like, I think the ultimate desire is the lack of desire, like in some way, like the lack of the race of it. So almost like the infinite bagel is that kind of void. It's kind of nothing. But in some ways, that would be the ultimate desire, maybe, because you wouldn't keep chasing the next hit for that kind of Mackie D's meal or whatever it is of consumerism.
See, I thought it was a symbolism for the internet. So you have this ultimate access to all knowledge, and it almost becomes meaningless in the pit of Facebook. So we have that at the fingertips. We can go for absolutely anything. We could read Shakespeare. We could read everything. We could find analysis for everything. And with that ultimate access, the most searched thing is Kim Kardashian and kitten pictures. Like, and that's the reality of it. Whereas when sacred scrolls and you had a few books, there was a kind of preciousness to knowledge, and there was a reverence for knowledge that we don't have anymore. And that's why we've become like a post-truth, because everything's accessible and everything can be lied about, so it doesn't matter. And knowledge isn't as sacred or seen as sacred because you have ultimate access. So knowledge is almost meaningless, which then leads to the existential crisis of nihilism.
Yeah. And my understanding, I think what the film has been trying to say is that the reaction or a symptom of this, of the world in the internet and this, the things you're saying, that's is nihilism, is this disassociative kind of experience that we see in Evelyn a lot. But then her daughter, Joy, who we haven't mentioned, who becomes the main villain of the film. Her name's Jobu Tupaki, I've got that right. And she's a kind of like embodiment of this nihilism, and the because of the world that we're in, she's kind of similar to you know, in Rick and Morty. That's what it reminded me of. If anyone watches Rick and Morty, because that deals with the multiverse as well. And Rick, he's a similar character where he's like, nothing matters, because in a thousand other universes, you die in all of them. Well, he says it with these kind of crazy, kind of like irreverent things, you know, all the time. So nothing matters in this universe, because if we die here, there's still millions of others.
Am I evil?
Worse, you're smart. When you know nothing matters, the universe is yours. And I've never met a universe that was into it. The universe is basically an animal. It grazes on the ordinary. Creates infinite idiots just to eat them. Not unlike your friend Timmy.
Tommy.
Yeah, hardly matters now, sweetie.
Is there also something in that, though, about the loss of the passing down of culture and, you know, and the relationship and that leads to that? That they're expressing in that multiverse of what gets lost of our relationship to our history or where you come from, your family, your roots, the conversations that leads to that nihilistic kind of stance of nothing matters. The loss of connection, really, I suppose, and maybe authentic connection, you could call it, I suppose.
When you were saying that, Julie, it made me think of Naz talking about knowledge and, you know, the passing of knowledge and that being sacred, and kind of the word sort of respect came in my head, because there's a relationship between Evelyn's dad, who's there, and then it sort of made me think about kind of psychosis in a way, like not just sort of nihilism, but there's a lot of themes, I feel, of kind of mental experiences or distress or disconnection. But in some ways, some could describe like psychosis as an experience for which something's not had language. And it felt like there were some of them themes where it was kind of like, my dad's coming, don't tell him about your girlfriend. And there was this sort of lack of, it was just very pervasive, the kind of unspoken. Joy's character, for me, it was like, it was an unspoken nature. And then it almost like manifested in this sort of explosion of other realities, other possibilities, because her main reality wasn't able to be accepted, acknowledged. So it almost manifested in these other kind of ways.
It's almost like, do you know the boomer millennial Gen Z kind of conflict of going, right, well, you had it easy because you could just get a job, get a car and everything was fine. Why can't you do this? And it kind of almost, she got traumatized. She got broken under the expectations of her mother, and that's what caused it. So there's almost that scene of going, well, why did she become this nihilistic creature? It's because she was almost broken by the previous generation's expectations of her. And that trauma almost broke the world. So we expect new generations to live by the standards of older generations while maintaining respect and retaining all the balance and stuff. But actually, if you put negative associations with this is how you should live your life, you will break your children, and then the children will then re-traumatize you and break the world. So it's almost like that really vicious cycle of trauma.
Yeah, and I feel like Evelyn had that from her dad, because there's the bit where she's born and the first thing they say is, oh, I'm sorry, it's a girl. So that kind of narrative of disappointment, that you're a disappointment, life is a disappointment because of your gender, is then kind of passed down almost to from Evelyn then to Joy, that there's this kind of disappointment there somehow in kind of that Joy's not doing enough of her life. And that really struck me, the kind of intergenerational pressure, I guess, but also that kind of cultural context and that kind of conflict that comes there.
We were going to do a genogram, I think, at the start. I think Cesar was talking about doing a genogram, and then we went way off topic. But I totally agree with what you were saying, Becky, and that when I was thinking about how you would fit this into a genogram, for me, like, there was this, the fourth generation, which was the culture of the society that the dad was living in that hands over that child. And it's this invisible, it's just this voice, isn't it? Because I think you see it from the eyes of the doctor that's passing over the baby. So you never even see the face of this voice that sets off this whole series of events of disappointment and oppression.
But she turned out to be stubborn, aimless, a mess, just like a mother. But now I see it's okay that she's a mess. Because just like me,
there's a big part of this film. I mean, it covers so many different themes, and we could kind of focus on each one in a much bigger way. But yeah, this kind of intergenerational trauma of when Evelyn herself is rejected by her dad, and she even says to him, how did you do that? You know, how did you kind of just completely reject me or leave me? As a response to her pursuing her relationship with Waymond and coming to America. And then living with that guilt, living with that, having to manage that guilt for her life, and not being able to then really live a happy life with her husband, and then her repeating some of those expectations and cycles with her daughter Joy, who she names Joy. I mean, there's so much significance just in the name. But having to play that all out, and it's only when she comes to a realization about it and challenges her father that she's able to overcome and break the cycle of that.
Makes me think of them kind of replicative and corrective scripts that, like, you know, even Evelyn kind of in many ways seemed like it was a powerful experience, because it had a flashback quite often of this departure where, you know, she had to kind of leave and there was this disconnection, this rupture with her dad and stuff. But then interestingly, it seems like it replicates in terms of her expectations of Joy and what she should think she should do, even though she has this inner conflict. So, yeah, it makes me think of my own sort of transition to becoming a dad, and, like, you know, the things where you're like, oh, no, I'm not going to do that. And then you sort of slowly start noticing things, or someone's like, your dad walks like that or something, you're like, oh, no. But, like, there's something of an awareness, but a replication without people being aware. So it's almost, it dwells in somewhere that we might not be as aware of or can affect. So, and that seems to come through in the film a lot, I think.
When you were talking, I was thinking just of Evelyn Pat's story of not being able to choose her own partner, or choosing her own partner, and that coming with a rupture, and then that then being fed down to Joy also, that, you know, not feeling she can't choose her partner, you know, and how that, that in a way you could look at it as a, yeah, as a pattern that gets passed down as well, that that's fed into, even though of course in, there's an, another layer of course which is to do with her sexuality within this.
It's so intersectional, it's unbelievable. The entire movie could just be put into the intersectional tools, but there's something about it paralleling with therapy. And Waylon's a therapist because he guides her through this retrospective processing of a past, opens up this future possibilities of what you could be, and then gives her this breakthrough of kindness in the middle of it. And I thought, in my head, if you've got transgenerational trauma, going to therapy is that, what did he call it? Statistical improbable action. If you've had three generations of people never going to therapy, never talking about their feelings, never processing anything, going to therapy is that a jump point. You do something that's completely improbable that you'd never want to do, and it completely changes your life and it changes you to an alternative reality. So I saw therapy as being that moment of something that sounds, feels really weird that you're telling this evil person that you love them, but it actually, if you tell your demons you love them, you end up jumping and evolving into this creator being. So there's something about that for me, but I'm a therapist, so I would just go there.
Isn't that the message of the father throughout the film as well? Isn't that what he's trying to tell everyone works?
And that's what the googly eyes represent, right? And the googly eyes are a kind of visual and a from a kind of emotional, it's a complete contrast to the everything bagel. So the everything bagel is a circle with a hollow middle, right? And then you've got the eye with the black core. So in the world of like yin and yang, they really represent the two different ways. And I understood it as two different responses or ways to overcome the problems of the times, you know, kind of this nihilistic. You could either respond to the world that we're in with a nihilism and a kind of loss of meaning, loss of values, because everything, so many meanings could create no meaning, right? That's kind of where what we're saying, right? Like if you put too much flavors on bagel, it's not going to taste of anything. And if there's meanings everywhere, so like an example, everything has an opposite, right? So if you're saying I don't wear leather boots anymore, then what about the kind of the exploitation in the textile industry? You know, where there's always a kind of equal and opposite, and where do you find meaning within that? And through this kind of vastness that we're experiencing, we're exposed to, we can lose ourselves and lose meaning. So either we become nihilistic and have no meaning and become blunt and void and absent from the world, depressed perhaps, it's more of a depressed presentation. And the challenge to that is the googly eyes, kindness, lightheartedness. There's a sentence in the start of it's the very first words of the film, you know, the very first image of the film is Evelyn sitting there, and the mise-en-scene is her sitting there with all these tax receipts, complete craziness, and then she's got the CCTV to her left of all the different screens of the laundromat, and it's just a visual representation of almost like ADHD, this kind of information overload where you can't concentrate anything. And then Wayman comes in and she says, I don't have time to play. And that's the opening line of this film, which I thought was really telling.
The opening scene, just going back one step though, was the mirror. It's this beautiful, I love how film does it, very clever. So they zoom out and they somehow don't get the camera in the shot. And they've got this beautiful, happy family in the mirror. And you zoom out to this kind of almost really real. Like, I've met that couple, I've met that family, I've worked with that family. She's too busy, she's trying to hold it together, she thinks she's doing everything for the family, and he's being neglected. And it's miscommunication on multiple levels. And there's something about, I love the switching between languages, because as a bilingual, I love that. And I've always, the idea of translation is never possible. In translation, it's always interpretation. And because of interpretation, you will always mix context. So if I try and interpret an Urdu session to a non-Urdu speaker, I can never fully translate directly what's been going on, because through translation, what you're doing is interpreting the meaning, and then you miss the context, so therefore you miss the point. So that switching between languages, and I don't not being able to speak it, I think that was so powerful, and about miscommunication in that family network. There's a really interesting book about intersectionality and reframing intersectionality by Jennifer Nash. And in it, she talks about feminist rights and kind of anti-racism and anti-racist practice. And she talks about the importance of love. And I was part of a reading group and I was just like, I can't stand, I don't know where, if it was where I was at in life. I can't stand this narrative of love your oppressor. And that's the way through it. Because I was more of a Fanonian balance is necessary kind of girl. But I think as I'm getting older, the more and more I'm seeing it, there is something about that necessity to love what you dislike or love what you hate for it to be cured, or that act of kindness despite everything. So she hugs and accepts her daughter at the end of it when she starts off with going, oh yeah, her partner is just a best friend, because she's compartmentalizing that relationship and she fully, wholly accepts her at the end through kindness. So there's something about that power of loving what you hate as a response to oppression or violence, cultural violence around you.
I feel like the whole film almost kind of leads up to this kind of both and, where, you know, at the end she kind of says, yeah, you are fat and you are, and you know, you're not doing anything with your life and I want to be with you and I love you. And, you know, and it's kind of, it's that kind of what you were saying there, said about the kind of polar opposites, and they've always been a kind of yin and yang. And then as you were saying, as I feel like, yeah, it all comes to this both and there's a line there where, like, I think Joyce says, it's, I don't know, it really stuck with me because of that kind of mother-daughter relationship. It says, I know the joy and pain of having you as a mother. And I was like, oh yeah, that, I don't know, it's really, that was really visceral for me. And I was like, oh yeah, I've kind of been there. I understand that feeling. Of how, and how you hold sometimes those really contrasting feelings or experiences. Yeah.
It was really powerful, that I'm just sort of recollecting it now, but I thought that was such a powerful scene, like that bit of dialogue as well, where if I think about in my head now, I've got like a yin and yang, but then it's moved into a googly eye, so like the part is moving around a little bit. But even that in itself is the both and kind of position. Each of the points of the, you know, each part of the yin and yang completes each other, really. So it's like, you know, order completes chaos and chaos completes order. They're sort of intermingled in such a way. And I think their relationship is so intermingled, it's very difficult to kind of separate. But like that bit of dialogue, it sort of illustrates that a bit of that joy is in the pain and a bit of the pain is in the joy. So they sort of have this circular kind of causality, like, between them, which I really liked. And that scene just, like, is so powerful at the end.
I love that because it reminds me of this kind of the journey of therapy. So it starts off really kind of psychoanalytical. It's about your inner child, it's about the id, it's about the ego. And even the movie starts off very polarized and analytical, and at the end they basically come to the Batesonian systemic conclusion of both and, everything's connected and everything both and. So even the movie, the journey in the movie is that therapeutic journey of, yeah, we started off analytical and we came to the conclusion that actually the balance in systemic is the answer, which I apologize to. And I was initially trained as psychoanalytical, so I can say that with my own personal journey as well.
I think Waymond, as the therapist, Naz, when you were saying that, then equally illustrates a journey through time where a reverence and kind of, you know, something where he is showing position, yet he's alongside, like being with rather than kind of doing to. So even the trajectory of his him as the therapist kind of illustrates that pretty well.
Yeah. There's, you know, the alpha Waymond, there's a moment in that when Evelyn first discovers that the main baddie of the film is actually her daughter, it cuts to Waymond and he's in that van, almost like Matrix-like, if you remember it, and he's like plugged into something and he's like, don't engage with her. Like, you know, it's like this, it's kind of like behind the mirror screen of what a therapist might say. But it was also kind of speaking to, you know, like, the difficulties of talking to your teenage child who's full of rage and NVR stuff was coming from me as well, thinking about that, how difficult that moment is in the face of this rage of the teenage daughter that you've also created. You know, you've created this rage within.
Mom!
yeah, Wayman as the therapist is an interesting concept. Mm.
The change only comes about when they each start to take slightly different positions as well, doesn't it? Because first of all, Evelyn learns to be a bit more curious and a bit more interested and caring, rather than holding this view of, I can't remember Joy's evil name, but that she's become this bad, she's this devil. But then Evelyn changes posture and becomes a bit more curious and interested to know what's actually going on and what's behind it. And then Joy's character then becomes more able to be vulnerable and actually share the dilemmas that she's experiencing with life. And I suppose like showing her the bagel is a bit like showing her what's actually going on inside her mind. Trusting Evelyn's character with that insight into what's going on for her. And it's responded to with love, which seems to solve it all.
Yeah. I was waiting for when you bring that in, Danilin.
Yeah. You are known for it, Danilin. But I guess when you were talking, Danilin, it made me think of a contradiction in a way. That Evelyn's kind of life seemed kind of, relative to Joy, kind of meaningful in terms of, you know, it's important. She's running this place and she's going to do her taxes. And Joy's was kind of like, you're just bumming around. Like, what are you doing? Then actually, in when this stepped into the kind of multiverse, Joy's character had so much like vibrancy and so much color. But then Evelyn's often seemed very drab, you know, like just her, the colour in her skin, even like she looked kind of pale a lot of the time and exhausted. And so it was almost this flip as well at times where Joy's, well, I think it was Job who's like, just the outfit she was wearing were outlandish, like some crazy kind of stuff going on. So it was just even like maybe the internal world was able to, it had more tolerance for creativity, whereas the kind of, the less malleable world, it, the way it was filmed as well, it was, yeah, I love that scene at the end because pops of colour come into it. So the world's kind of blurred. The colours, like, I think the colour is, like, quite a good conduit for some of the ideas in the film.
It's interesting we talk about the kindness, the point of kindness, but that's the third turn. The second turn is when she has to die. She actually died in the first act. So you almost either death of self or death of something or death of your belief or something has to die within you, which then leads her into the existential crisis to then she can empathise with the daughter's position. Because she starts off in denial and it's almost like the perfect therapy session. That is how you get this family in chaos, in this kind of miscommunication, not understanding, and you guide them through going, what's led you to this trauma? What are your future possibilities around? And can you teach each other and reposition each other in a different way? But she has to die in order for that to happen.
It's like Harry Potter and the Horcrux, right?
I know, all right. Yes, Danilin, Harry Potter reference every single time. Love it.
I don't know what you guys are on about, but I'll look it up.
I'll get you the book, don't worry.
I think it was one as well where she had a relationship, didn't she, with Jamie Lee Curtis, I think. Oh my word, we've not even gone into the sausage fingers.
Yeah.
Perfect segue for the sausage fingers. Yeah. But it made me think that even her sexuality was able to be expressed in a different way when the kind of context changed. But anyway, on to the most important part of today's podcast, the sausage fingers.
It does a little story, doesn't it, about the evolution of the ape, who, and it's the normal, the ape with a normal thumb who gets killed by an ape with sausage fingers, and then that reality. It's just so absurd, isn't it?
That was a little nod to Space Odyssey, isn't it?
It's a shout out to that, is it?
I mean, there was so much that was really surreal and kind of absurd in it. And it's kind of, again, it's that sort of, it's a film that actually is really deep, and it's talking about really like significant themes and issues. And at the same time, it's ridiculous, and it's, you know, got these kind of amazing visual images of men leaping onto like butt plugs and you know, and you just these kind of ridiculous things happen that are kind of amazing. Yeah, I guess it is. It is in the title, isn't it? That everything, everywhere, all at once.
And Rakakuni. We haven't mentioned Rakakuni, right? I mean, there's something about it, and I don't know how I'm going to quite say this, but it'd be useful to explore with you lot. About the film being a bit of a critique of postmodernism is how I was beginning to formulate my mind, where postmodernism, the idea that there are kind of multiple meanings and that it kind of challenges the normative structures, and postmodernism was a reaction to that, right? And in a way, the internet kind of came out of that. It kind of felt like a bit of a catalyst for you can now create so many realities and cultures and values. But where I saw it as a bit of a criticism was because it was talking about the dangers of that and not moving away from kind of individuality, you know, which is what postmodernism kind of tries to celebrate, to an individualization, to a doing to people where we're now forced to have no meaning. We haven't chosen to not have meaning. And we're kind of thrust upon this way of living now. And how do we cope with this? Or how do we help our children to live in an age where this is their everyday experience? Where for Evelyn, she didn't grow up in that culture, you know? And how does she now help her daughter who is living in this? And that challenge, I thought, was really profound. You know?
And I guess it's how do we like transcend it as well? Because there's the Alphaverse people who want to kind of take it all back to the way it was. So they kind of talk about actually we need to, I can't remember exactly what they say, but yeah, we need to kind of go back to how it was. We want to kind of, a bit like the culture wars in some way at the moment, where you have like some groups of people saying actually we want to kind of take everything back almost to kind of, I don't know, pre internet, I don't know, probably earlier than the 50s, whatever it feels to, you know, that they want to kind of do that. And actually, you know, Evelyn decides to reject that idea in the end and goes for this more sort of transcendental way of kind of approaching it, of bringing things together. I don't know if there's any like learning for our society within that. I don't know.
It's an interesting nice stance. I guess they want ignorance, don't they? I hadn't really thought about it that way.
Who want ignorance?
The alpha world. Yeah. They see ignorance as bliss. We don't want to be connected. We don't want to know.
For me, I guess at the end, I saw it as a bit of a kind of, even though there was all this going on and there was all these potential like dichotomies, dilemmas, like paradoxes, what I enjoyed was it zoomed into the relationship. So it became very relational, like, which is very similar to, I guess, our world in a way, that we're seeking to be alongside people. And there's such a like, kind of like a neg entropy, like just an infinite expanse of like more and more and more, like an expanding universe of people's lives, what's going on. The government, the social layers, and it zooms out so much. But I guess we're trying to like foreground and focus the relational aspects. And it felt like the film did that. It expanded so much. Almost made me think of like Pac-Man. You know, Pac-Man, you kind of go off the screen and the furthest point at the end of the screen is like the closest point. Like the exit point is the entry point. Like, so in some ways, with Pac-Man, where the furthest point away is actually the closest because you kind of come back in. It felt a bit like that in the film. You know, in some ways, we've gone so far out, it kind of zoomed back to the most fundamental like relationship in their lives.
Yeah, at one point I tried to put down what the different, like the three acts, you know, the kind of act one, like everything, act two, everywhere, and then act three, all at once. I don't know what they kind of represented. I found it quite hard. But what I basically came to at the end was that the kind of act three was around, it was the connection. It was like the all at once was actually that feeling of connection. And that's what kind of brought it all together.
Yeah, because
like Joe Buttapaki, she's experiencing this kind of nihilism and this kind of drive to end the world because she experiences it, everything all at once, right? And then it's only when Evelyn enters that world and she also experiences everything everywhere all at once, that she begins to, well, she initially she's pulled into that kind of nihilistic world as well, when she's kind of physically about to go into the bagel, and then through Wayman's, or her own realization, but through the connection she makes to all everything all at once, the different experiences, she's able to kind of find a different way. So yeah, so that's how I understood it as well, that all at once was Evelyn showing this is how we can manage this, through kindness and through empathy, and through, instead of shooting bullets, I'm going to shoot glitter and googly eyes. And the ending is just the most hilarious ending as a fight scene. I mean, it's completely absurd, but it just shows that, I think she says it, doesn't she, to Wayman, where she says, I'm going to fight like you now, or something like that. I've really messed up the words, but in essence is, I'm going to fight with kindness. And that's what she does.
What are you doing? I'm learning to fight like you.
I think this movie is based on your dream. In fact, if I ever teach Bateson, fully teach a course on Bateson, the first thing is going to be, watch this movie, then come back to me. Because I think there's something so powerful about, and even when, it's interesting because we're talking about nihilism and that's what the kind of movie's representing, but Bateson talks about everything's connected, but he didn't lead it to nihilism. For Bateson, everything being connected was actually this really almost profound, connected, relational, spiritual, powerful, going back to pre-division versus this nihilistic, well, if everything's connected, then everything's meaningless. So it's that interesting that they've actually come to the Batesonian conclusion rather than that, well, if you know everything, then forget it, what's the point?
But in a way, isn't it, I'm thinking, says about what you said, and I always think of it as a piece of paper. If you've got one thing, you've got the other. So it can't ever be completely meaningless. It has to be all the connection and meaning as well, isn't it? I mean, I keep thinking of Buddhism, actually, throughout this whole conversation. That's what's been going, rolling around in my head. You know, just coming back, like you said, and not when it actually gets so big that you bring it back down to just the present and what's in front of you. And for them, it's their family and it's that connection, and it's holding all of those different perspectives that leads to the understanding, which ultimately can only lead to the kindness and the love that is there and was always there that they couldn't see.
The way I find that most beautifully represented in the film is in that scene that Becky found as like a really great reprieve, which I also did when they're the rocks, and one rock rolls, Joy's rock rolls over the cliff to try and say, "That's it, I've had enough," and then Evelyn's rock rolls after her. For me, that just like distilled the whole movie down in that one scene, like that one moment captured like so much meaning for the movie.
It was such a powerful scene. I mean, I have to confess, I was in tears watching that film the second time, genuinely. And I don't know if I'd woke up too early to watch it, so I hadn't quite regulated myself. But that scene itself, that reprieve from the madness of what was coming before, allowed me to reflect. And I just found so much meaning in that one little bit of a rock with a googly eye stuck to it. And it was so powerful. I think, you know, there's a saying, right? The more you stare at something, you will eventually find meaning. You know, if you keep staring at something, and there was something about that rock, or the and also the change of pace, like it gave me the opportunity to reflect on what was going on.
It just reminds me of the parents that bring in kids and going, my child is broken, fix them. Like, I don't know why this weird creature happened. And at that point, they don't realise the kind of almost trauma or damage or anything that, not intentionally or unintentionally, they've done to their child. And they've almost descended into madness themselves because this child has just been a horrible, and this is not what they wanted to raise, because they had that kind of absolute love for them, and I wanted this child to love me unconditionally. And then they bring you to a therapist and going, fix this thing that, and you always end up, I always go to the, maybe we should try some family-assisted or parent-assisted therapy, because that would be really useful, because it's never just the kid. It's never just one person. And it's going back to what Bateson said about a singular, there's not A singular part can't have unilateral decision-making over the whole. So if you've got multiple parts spinning, one thing in that can't fix the whole system. Everything in the system has to change, and because it's interconnected. So the idea within Western individualism and the power of the individual is contrasted by this, actually, you need to do it as a collective. The only way you're going to make significant change is as a collective. You have to change it altogether. So if you look at like big problems like global warming or racism or LGBT rights and things like that, it can't be just one person fighting for that. It has to be allies. It has to be everyone doing it.
And in some way, it almost doesn't matter where the collective is going as long as they're going together. You don't see where the rocks fall. You just see them falling, and they're falling together. And that's okay. There's peace in the fact that they're together.
Oh, Duncan, you're the hopeless romantic in our group. Okay, it always comes down to love. That's lovely.
I did want to mention the title itself and what people made of it. I know, Becky, you've kind of broke it down a little bit in the narrative, but what people's thoughts are, because for me, that those words, everything, everywhere, all at once, has now come into my lexicon of explaining how I feel about being overwhelmed. Mm. You know, when someone's like, how you doing, Cez? I might be like, I feel like I want to say, rather than, oh, I'm so busy. I think those words fit now. I feel like I'm everywhere doing everything all at once. I think it represents something for me really powerfully.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Like, I think when Becky, you was in my head, there's obviously them like acts the way they sort of break it up. But in my head, it was almost like everything to me felt like capitalism or consumerism or possessing. Like, for me, if I had to distill it, I think everything was like doing. You know, it was doing stuff, and then everywhere was kind of like having, maybe, like it was kind of almost doing stuff to then have stuff, and then the final act was like being. You know, when you were saying, Becky, it felt like kind of being in the moment, being connected, but then there was definite themes around kind of like, yeah, capitalism or modern life around possessing things. And it made me think of different, like, I really like poetry, so thinking of different poems in different cultures and what they seek to kind of define, whether it's, like, there was one poem, I think it was by Tennessee, and it was about a flower, and it was about kind of possessing the flower and taking the flower, but then the flower died because picked the flower. And then Basho did a poem talking about just seeing the flower but never touching or interacting with it. So it still died, but he didn't interact with it. And then I can't remember that there was another poem which was more about kind of interacting with it, but moving it to a more habitable place. So in a way, the film to me was like, there was all these cultural kind of connections as well about possession, about kind of distance and disconnection. And then about ultimately, like Dan and Lynn summarized nicely, was rolling down the hill together kind of thing. Mm.
And there's quite an interesting one that Evelyn thinks that they think that Joe Boutabaki, I think the apparently it was just a collection of sounds that the directors and writers decided to put together, I guess, showing that sort of chaos in some ways. But when everyone thinks that she's trying to find Evelyn because she wants to kill her. But actually, that's not what she's trying to do. She's trying to find her. She says that, like, I'm trying to find you so that I can find someone else who can feel what I feel. And I just think that's so powerful as well. This actually, and it really made me think about, again, a bit as what you were saying, that when there's parents who kind of see their children and they kind of think they're deliberately out to hurt them, they're like, well, they're doing it to hurt me, or they're doing it deliberately. And actually, once you start to unpack that and look underneath at what maybe some of the intention is behind the child's behavior, or even behind, you know, what parents are saying and their behavior, is that actually everyone is kind of looking for the same thing. They're looking for that connection. They're just showing it in different ways.
Why would anybody want to kill me?
She's an omniversal being with unimaginable power, an agent of pure chaos with no real motives or desires. Joe Boutabaki.
You're just making up sounds.
You're Juju Tubuti. It's her. Juju Chewbacca.
I am going to defeat the Jobu Tupaki.
Hey, you got her name right.
So it was, Naz, there was loads of clips that I just wanted to use for different parent groups as well. And the MVR concept of parental presence, that idea of actually just being able to be with, really powerful.
To look at the bagel together.
Yeah.
What does she want? No one knows. All we know is she's looking for you.
The other connection that I was making was about the role of a systemic family therapist and being everywhere, everything, all at once. The context that's going on for the family, the relationships that's experienced in front of me, the communication, all of that stuff, and then the wider context, and then my stuff and my family scripts and my context and my day and how it's been, and then the interaction. It could just feel so overwhelming as a family therapist, and you beg for those little moments of the rock, you know, where there's some silence. But yeah, I thought there was a bit of a connection there of how it feels to be as a family therapist sometimes.
I was thinking about the different responses to feeling everything everywhere all at once. So is it the numbing and just kind of all disconnecting and not being present? Is it the kind of manic and just going, I'm going all rogue and I'm just going to go absolutely manic and kill everything and kill everything around me? Or is that not feeling anything? So there's almost a different positions of when you feel that. How do you respond? Do you go psychotic? Do you go dissociative? What happens? Because when you get like that, I get numb. When it's too much going on, especially around this time of year, I'm just like, yeah, I'm tired now. I'm turning off. So there's a numbing effect that it can have. It can also have like a manic effect on you as well, feeling like you're just not connected to anything. And it's almost a connection that's grounding back relationally to anchor you when there's everything everywhere all at once. And that's either your family or your home or usually a connection to another person that grounds you within that chaos.
I don't know if I think of everything everywhere all at once as chaos and overwhelm. I think of it as it's your relationship. Well, yes, it's a bit what you were saying, Naz. It's just your relationship to it, because everything everywhere all at once is what is being alive, is what you're immersed in. So you're never going to escape it. It's just how you relate to it. So it's just showing, in a way, if you wanted to look at the title, it's showing you different perspectives, which might end up as the rock or whatever. But it's, in a way, that's our journey. That's our way of finding our way back to the peace within that everything everywhere all at once, because it's never not there.
Similar to you, Julie, I kind of connected to that, because it's like whether you choose it, like whether you tune into it or not, is it present anyway? And you're just, you know, sometimes where you might walk past something 100 times, and then when it's relevant, you might say, oh wow, okay, that poster, that gig, that looks amazing, but I've seen it 100 times. We didn't tune into kind of what was present anyway. Because I definitely felt like the sort of film as a whole, it generated a lot of that, you know. A lot of it was kind of perceptions. So I absolutely loved Wayman, quality character, like really sort of related to him. I might make some kind of fan club, like Everybody Loves Wayman, could be like a spin-off pro show maybe. The perception of him in parts of the film was, you're just quite passive. Like it felt to me like he was kind of portrayed a bit at times as, but then when he redefined why he was doing what he was doing, what he was actually doing, I really related to that character in a way that the perception was, his response to this chaos or the reality, you know, of life was this, like a bit of a passenger. But I just liked the fact that he said, oh no, like it looks like I'm doing that, but I'm actually doing this. And then he transformed everyone in the film, which, yeah, I love that kind of idea.
I think you should make some t-shirts saying vote Wayman. That's what I'm waiting for.
Let's do it.
The link to ADHD, a quick comment on that as well, is if everything everywhere all at once has this sensation of stimulus overload, and they were trying to represent how it might feel to have ADHD at certain points, and commenting on that's a symptom of our times, of the age of the internet. I know we've kind of gone on this, but I wonder how that ties into the bit of an epidemic of a mass increase of ADHD assessments. And something that's come into a bit of a social discourse now where parents, schools, I mean, many people, you know, say, okay, that child has ADHD. You know, it's such an easy place to get to now. And are we just creating this sense in people, in children, in adults, because of this overload? And it's not really a neurodevelopmental thing, but it's a reaction to this overload that we have.
So I do ADHD assessments, and I always kind of have that question of going, is this ADHD or is this just trauma? Because if you look at, especially early signs of like ADHD and trauma, it can look so similar. And where do you actually know what the difference is? And is it like neuropathological? Is it something functional, organic underneath it? Or is it functional? Is it behavioural? Because the hypervigilance, the feeling overstimulated, the not being able to connect, that can also be trauma responses. So it depends on how you read it. And I think there's something really interesting about working in mental health or working with families. There's always going to be fancy new words for things. And we'll always like to attach labels to meaning and understanding a set of behaviours and feelings. And sometimes it's really reassuring because it gives you access. If you've got ADHD, you've got access to a treatment, you've got access to funds, you've got access to something. But when you boil it down in therapy, it's almost irrelevant what you call something. They, like a client might score, it's my twisted little mind. I was like, right, twisted little mind it is then. You use the language because what you call it is irrelevant and how you formulate it is irrelevant. It's almost how do you experience it? That's the point. And it's going back to how did we all experience that movie? Did it rejuvenate us? Did it make us exhausted? Did it overwhelm us? So these experiences that we have, how do we live that experience rather than what do we call it?
You're going to have to add internet to the third one. So if it's trauma, ADHD, or response to the internet now, I'll give you the...
Post-pandemic syndrome is the new one. Everything's caused by, oh, it's because of the pandemic. It's like, oh, great.
Look, let's try and get to an ending. And maybe we should talk about the ending, the final scene of the film. A really heartwarming ending where they're back at the tax office now. And it's Evelyn Waymond, who Evelyn, just before they get back to the tax office, pulls Waymond to a side and kisses him, doesn't she? So she shows him her love and their relationship is back to a place of being healthy. And then they're there with the granddad, with Jamie Lee Curtis, who's the tax auditor, who's now also a bit more sympathetic around their situation. And Joy is also there, who was absent the last time they were in the same exact scene. And she was absent there because of their difficulties, but this time things have been repaired and she's now functioning in her role as the daughter who helps with the translation. I thought it was such a beautiful scene, and it ends with Evelyn still having this moment of disassociation, it looks like. And Jamie Lee Curtis's character's like, are you listening? And she's like, she's not disassociating where previously she was like freaking out of like, what's going on? I'm in this multiverse and all these things. This time she was like taking a step back and enjoying her family. That's how it looked to me. But she's kind of just taking a moment and looking at her daughter, looking at her dad, looking at Waymond. And then that's broken. Why are you listening? And she's like, yeah, sorry. And then it just ends. You know, beautiful, beautiful, kind of a whole circular kind of connection back. What did other people make of the ending?
I think that circular kind of makes me think of Wizard of Oz as well. Like, once you zoom out, things get been kind of bend around the edges and things do become spherical and circular kind of thing. Basically, my favourite quote, I find any opportunity to just say this quote because I love this quote. So it's probably something I'll say on every episode, maybe. But it seems very relevant. Like T.S. Eliot's got the poem Little Gidding, and he says, we shall not cease from exploration, and at the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. For me, that's like encapsulates the film, really. It's like the Pac-Man ending, like the end is the beginning, but it's transformed. Like the relationships are transformed because of the exploration. So for me, it's like the exploring generates the scene at the end because it's transformed by the experiences.
And that's a lovely way of summing it up. And yeah, it feels like it really hits for the end.
I think when you contrast it to the beginning, it's so powerful because there's a scene, this one line that she says, and it absolutely gutted me. I had to pause it and take a breath because I was like, oh, I'm going to cry. Don't. It's when she turns around to the tax officer and goes, why do you have to make all the language complicated? Like, is it to confuse it? And it's something about that kind of history or legacy from coming from like an immigrant family. And like, I'm third generation now. And I can imagine the kind of struggles of my grandparents that couldn't speak English, or the struggles of people that go to see a psychiatrist, or and we don't know the language and they don't have the access. And it's such a desperate moment of just needing somebody to help translate. And then having that unified confronting that figure, it's almost that everything becomes easier, everything becomes nicer. So I think it was more powerful at the end, because it's like, oh, thank God you've got somebody who can help translate and navigate that. And it just reminds me, I think I went the next day and made sure every word I spoke was non-psychiatric, just to remind myself that linguistically we can confuse people.
It's a transformative film, right? The experience of watching that film, I really wish I could prescribe it to everyone. The ending scene, again, where the family's operating well, and I wonder if that's the same family at the very first scene, what you mentioned, Naz, you know, in the mirror, the opening image of this happy family. I think they're like, are they doing karaoke or they're singing together, something like that? And I wonder if it's that reality that we're transported to, where the rest of the film doesn't even happen. You know, it's that happy family and then we're seeing them at the end, and all of this is just another episode. I don't know.
It's interesting. So the next, I watched it, and the next morning, I jammed hip hop in the morning. And I swear to you, the first track that came on was The Game, If I Could Start From Scratch. And as soon as it hit, I'm like, oh, this is so deep. It's so connected to last night. Like, you've had this really heavy night out, and it's just reminded you of it. And the whole thing about that track is, if I could start from scratch, I wouldn't change anything. I'd just start where I started. And it's almost that. It's that everything's changed, but nothing has that at the same time, because they're still the same people. But everything about it has changed and reformed. So yeah, I was tripping the next morning as well.
That sounds like a nice place to end. I mean, we could probably talk for another hour or two about this film. And it is a fantastic film, and recommend it for everyone, everywhere to watch.
All the time.
Yes.
Once.
More than once. Well, thanks a lot, everyone, for joining us on this. We look forward to the next one.